I'm unemployable. I don't like working for other people at all. I don't think I could go into a full-time job working for other people. I really enjoy doing what I enjoy doing, not being told what to do, I guess is probably the best way of putting it.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy and I am the CEO and co-founder at procurementexpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we are not here to speak about that today. Instead, I've got Arish Shah from Emerge One, and we're going to discuss Arish's storied existence as an operator and CFO and how he has managed to build an extremely successful fractional CFO business in 4 short years to more than 25 consultants. And along the way, we're going to take pit stops in places as varied as Papua New Guinea and London town. So Arish, thanks very much for coming along today. Maybe tell us a bit about yourself. Whereabouts in the world are you sitting today?
Yeah, look, thank you so much for having me on, James. Really appreciate it. I'm currently sat in my studio in Mill Hill. I say my studio, it sounds incredibly arrogant, but it's actually not my studio, but I do rent it out. So, yes, I'm in sunny North London at the moment.
Very good. I'm bringing a knife to a gunfight in this podcast. Aaron looks fantastic. If you're not watching on YouTube, he's got all the lighting and everything. So just on that slight tangent, so you've decided to go all on this sort of media thing. I feel like for podcasting, no one ever read the blogs that I did, but I met a guy this morning. He said, yeah, I listened to 12 of your podcasts, which that would never have happened if I wrote 12 blogs, right? What's your experience of being as podcasting as a sort of biz dev, especially in the finance world?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. It's one that we talk about a lot. So I think there are various reasons to do a podcast, right? You do a podcast to explore, to learn. You do a podcast because there's a topic that you're super interested in and want to discuss and dissect. I think you do a podcast because you're trying to create content and social proof for yourself or your business. Or you do a podcast because you're just interested in speaking to people. So when I started the podcast, which, wow, is, you know, back in May 2021 now, it really was an exploration of the relationships I had. I had such deep and meaningful relationships within the venture community that I thought, well, we were coming out of lockdown number 3 at the time. I was like, well, I'm a bit bored. I have these great relationships. I would love to explore their stories and learn more about them. And because I'm sort of geeky about finance and VC and this sort of stuff, I thought this is a really good opportunity to kind of dig into their knowledge. And the podcast kind of evolved from there. But realistically today, the podcast is as much an opportunity for me to sit in a room for an hour with someone that I would not necessarily otherwise be able to carve an hour of their time out with and really build, you know, further relationships, because obviously there is a limit to the number of relationships that one person has at any one stage. And so you're constantly building on that. But what it allows me to do is A, get a really deep understanding of how they and their firms work. And it's not just VCs. I do interview founders and angels and operators and other people within the VC ecosystem. But certainly with the VCs, it allows me to understand their firms, themselves as investors, what kind of piques their interest, how they think about portfolio construction, all of the sort of, as I say, really geeky VC stuff. But, you know, most importantly, it allows me to build that relationship. So, you know, does it work from a biz dev perspective? I don't think I can actually answer that question. We get referrals in from all over the place. We certainly get them from guests that have been on the podcast, but we equally don't necessarily only get them from guests that have been on the podcast. I think what the podcast does, and this is really the answer to your question, is, at least for me and for Nothing Ventured, is it builds that social proof that you are someone who understands the domain within which you are working and have relationships with people that matter within the domain that you are working. And I think, you know, if there are founders out there that are looking for fractional CFOs and they come across my profile, and I actually had this conversation with a couple of people recently, you know, they had searched for fractional CFO, had never come across my content in the past, but clearly, you know, took a look at my page, saw that, you know, I have 17,500, you know, followers on LinkedIn or whatever the number is today. And you know, the podcast and a newsletter and a lot of content around the space that I'm in and engagement with that content. I think that allows them to sort of say, well, okay, this is certainly someone that I should be speaking to if nothing else, right? If I'm looking for these sort of specific services. So yeah, I think more than anything else, it acts as social proof and validation, really, that, you know, you aren't just some Joe off the street.
You remind me somewhat of myself when my business partner asked me, so what are you doing that podcast for again? And I think those reasons are valid and probably true. I see it also as sales enablement, if you have to look at that policy. So, you know, we have very good competitors and we all have very nice websites. And, you know, what's the difference? It's the difference of like people being able to get. And then in the age of AI, you can't believe any blog you write anymore. We should probably prove that we're not yet replaced here on this podcast by an AI. I'm sure that's coming through soon. But really, if no one watches, I think the same thing. It's just like networking. I'm one of those guys who, you know, you go to a cocktail party and I feel a little awkward until I'm waiting for someone to start talking business and then I'm away and everything in between is just a little bit. So this is an excuse just to talk unfiltered business with people.
Yeah, 100%. Look, and I grew up essentially in a world, you know, in a pre-mobile platform world, right? And certainly in the various places I've worked, I know we're going to come on to a couple of those. Everything was built around relationships. And in fact, I see relationships as the most critical part of any business. You have to build relationships with your employees, with your suppliers, with your customers, with your, you know, third-party vendors and everyone in between. And those relationships are not transactional in nature, i.e., you know, you and I might be doing this podcast today and I may have zero requirement for your services today and you may have no requirement for mine either. But in 6 months or 12 months or 18 months, often, and I really do find this happens often, something comes up. And in fact, actually, more often than not, it happens sooner than one expects, because now that you're on my radar, my brain is thinking about, well, okay, how can I help James? What are the things that might be interesting? If something comes across to us, which isn't right for us, but is right for you, then obviously I'm much more likely to send it to you, having met you and spoken to you and now spoken to, you know, for the length of this podcast, however long that might be. That's going to be much more likely than just, you know, searching on Google who's good in the procurement space, right?
Yeah. And I guess it's like, well, certainly I would guess that if you're listening to this at this stage, you know, if you're listening to this thinking, well, you know, I would love to have people listening to this come onto the podcast. If anyone wants to reach out to me, or I'm sure in the Nothing Adventured podcast, you know, reach out. I think hosts, we like having people come out. It's actually part of the point. Even if we recorded it, put it in the bin, never put it on the internet, it doesn't matter. It's still quite a good conversation to have for me. So Arish, let's get back to your, because you have quite an interesting back. You were saying that before we started, less than 0.00 something percent of people have ever gone to Papua New Guinea, but somehow you ended up there. What did you do to deserve being banished out to the never regions of Australasia?
It's a fairly long and complicated story, one that I can't necessarily tell in its entirety on this show. But what I will say is, look, I graduated with a degree in languages, which I realized were useful but not essential. And a fun fact, Papua New Guinea has something like the most diverse ecosystem of languages on the planet. I think there are more than 800 languages spoken in a population of, you know, less than 8 or 9 million. But I studied languages and then ended up actually working with Pricewaterhouse, BPO, Nortel Networks and Deutsche Bank in finance in various guises, qualified as a chartered management accountant along the way, but have never been an accountant. And that was kind of the end of my traditional career. I up sticks and moved to Papua New Guinea essentially because my family has had businesses throughout sort of the developing world, I guess is potentially the best way of putting it, but certainly sub-Saharan Africa and then New Guinea, Australia, Papua New Hong Kong, India, the UK and elsewhere. And so I was sort of sent to PNG to kind of cut my teeth and learn the business. Interestingly, whilst it was a sort of family enterprise, it was also a very hard learning curve, you know, to grapple with. You know, a lot of people sort of assume that if you come from a family background, you have privilege sort of, you know, ingrained. And certainly, you know, there's no doubt that I have been privileged in my life, but I would challenge anyone to go out to Papua New Guinea with a wife and a young kid at the age of, I think I was about 20, 27 at the time, and tell me that you're privileged in that experience. It's a pretty tough environment to be operating.
Well, my uncle actually was a partner in PwC in Port Moresby a little bit before your time, I think, John Duggan is his name. And it was kind of a career move. Like, yeah, if you went to it wasn't high on Sydney and London or New York were higher on people's agendas probably, But he used it as a way to sort of get ahead, if you like.
It's a stepping stone for sure, yeah.
And when you moved back to the main practice then, did that pay off as a career move? Let's put it that way. You know, because I remember my uncle saying, well, that was all very well. He was partner in PNG. But then when he went back to Australia, they were like, well, you might have been a partner out there, but you have to prove your worth again all over again here. Well,
yeah. I know a lot of partners from various firms out in New Guinea. You know, I was very close with people at Deloitte, KPMG, PwC, and others. And actually, all of those that I knew very much were partner material in other nations by this stage. And I think, you know, as you said, your uncle was maybe out there in the early 80s, yeah. late 80s, early 90s. By the time I was out there, or shortly after I arrived, a liquefied natural gas plant was built by Exxon, which sort of injected $20 billion into the economy. It was a very large project with large impact, very negative impact down the track as well. But or certainly when they stopped building, because all of a sudden all of the people and the cash that was running around the economy sort of disappeared and shrunk overnight. So that had its challenges. But what it meant was that you needed very strong people to be out there, right? You couldn't kind of phone it in. So what I would say is that, you know, most of the people I knew in Papua New Guinea were real strivers, right? Like, I mean, they you know, they went out there in hardship conditions and built actually some pretty incredible and impressive stuff. And those that were in the banks or in the accounting firms or in the law firms, you know, by no stretch of the imagination were they, you know, in a cushy job, you know, out there. And so, yeah, so most of the partners at those sort of firms that I knew that were partners in New Guinea actually did sort of carry on the partnership track elsewhere. Occasionally, yes, of course, you know, you're going to have the odd one or two who isn't necessarily quite up to the scratch for a larger firm in another, you know, in a more developed jurisdiction. But, you know, I don't think.
Great experience for earlier in your career. You know, you're sort of a trial by fire, I would imagine, in a lot of ways. And what was the biggest challenge you had to face? Because it's quite business, as you alluded to there, is we're a little bit living in Disneyland here. And when you go out to other nations, sometimes things are different. So what was the biggest challenge that you had to face when you were down there?
I mean, you could pick a million out of a hat, to be honest. So yeah, I mean, obviously you sort of alluded to there. I wouldn't say it was the biggest challenge, but it was the most interesting and potentially sort of difficult experiences that I'd ever been to, which was, you know, I was spending by this stage sort of 2-3 weeks in New Guinea and then coming back to the family who were at this time in Melbourne and spending a couple of weeks there. So I remember this was sort of late on a Friday evening. I'd flown back into Melbourne, was sort of, you know, had jumped into the showers, about to get into bed, and then got a phone call. And it was one of the team out in Leh, which is the second sort of, it was the industrial city out in Papua New Guinea. And he said, boss, the factory's burnt to the ground. What are you talking about? And, you know, obviously kind of had the conversation, but, you know, was back on a plane a day and a half later, back up to New Guinea. And essentially what had happened was, you know, we suffered from very poor power management out in New Guinea, and by power management on the actual national grid rather than sort of locally. And there'd been, you know, a number of brown and blackouts and so on. And essentially what had happened was one of those had caused a lamp to blow. And because we were manufacturing plastics, that had sparked some scrap waste, and that scrap waste had essentially set alight. And obviously plastics are, you know, made from petroleum, so they are slightly flammable. And lo and behold, when you have an entire factory full of the stuff, it doesn't take long for it to go up in smoke. So, you know, we lost a warehouse, multiple, you know, pieces of equipment, all our raw material, all our stock. You know, we were basically put out of business, or at least, you know, one would have imagined that would have been the result. And, you know, that fire lasted for, I don't know, I think there were still containers sort of burning and smoldering, you know, a week later. It was a really just incredible thing to have experienced. I mean, devastating, obviously, you know, for the business, for the employees, because we had to sadly let a number of them go. But yeah, as a challenge, I put it kind of up there for sure.
Yeah, pretty insane. And these days you kind of forget this happens. Like, but things were more dangerous. Like, factories did burn down. A lot more things went wrong, you know, at that stage.
And it's not even just because you're in a I mean, so at the same time this happened, I think within the space of a couple of months, one of the other businesses in Canada, which was a foam manufacturing business, had a significant fire that essentially burnt the entire thing to the ground. Now, one could try and draw conclusions from the fact that these things happen, those conclusions would be incorrect. But the reality is that, you know, it can happen anywhere. And it is, you know, it is not something that you can prepare for in the most basic ways, but you can be prepared, if I can put it that way.
Yeah. Okay. So interesting. I think that sort of in your 20s, it's great to get that sort of unusual experience because it gives you an unusual perspective and then later you can carry through. If there was like one lesson that you drew from that whole time there, like that you still do to use today, like was there one hack that you, that experience gave you that you still think, yeah, you know what, that was worth all of the trouble, that the fact that I now have this sort of outlook or view or technique that I use based on that time?
Yeah, so I think I'd call out two things. So the first is the importance of data. I mean, one of the first things, I mean, we're talking about a country which at the time I arrived, which was 2006, you know, they were still working off dial-up. There was no broadband. There were no mobile phones, or I think there was only about 1% mobile phone coverage, maybe 3%, something like that. So you really didn't have, you know, speed of access on the internet. And it meant that the systems that you use were equally sort of less robust. You didn't have cloud solutions in the same way that we do today. So I remember sort of one of the first things I did was, you know, I looked around and I was like, okay, well, the sales team don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So I started recording their daily deliveries and figuring out, you know, where our sales were tracking in real time, which obviously, you know, if you look at businesses today, that's pretty bog standard, and started sharing that information with the sales team. And all of a sudden we tripled our sales, right? And continued to do that on an ongoing basis, just because they knew what they were doing. They knew where their targets were. They knew how close they were, and they were incentivized against those. So I think the first thing, mm-hmm, is data is critical. The second thing, and, you know, this comes back to any business of any nature in any jurisdiction, cash is king. You know, you've got to manage your working capital. If you don't manage your working capital, you're dead. And, you know, for us, working capital was existential. You know, we were operating in an environment where we might order raw materials on an LC at site. So, you know, we're essentially, you're essentially paying for product before it's shipped. The goods then get shipped, take 3 months to ship and arrive at port. It may take 2 or 3 months to clear at port because there was just so much congestion and various other problems. Then you've got to get it into the factory. You've got to convert it into finished product. You've got to sell it. And then you've got to collect the cash, often from, you know, companies that are in the highlands, which, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, is the mountainous area of New Guinea, where it's a 13-hour drive, I think, to get, you know, from Ley to into the utmost areas. And it's a pretty dodgy place to be driving through at the best of times, and that's if the roads are actually not falling apart. So your working capital cycle was incredibly long. I mean, you know, it could be 6-7 months to go from, you know, purchase to recovering any cash. So you had to be on top of your working capital, and you had to figure out, you know, how the cash flow worked. And I always say, you know, if you can figure it out there, then working on a SaaS business in the UK is not so tough. So yeah. I think those are the two main ones.
Yeah, it's amazing to think. I suppose there are still businesses like that, but like the person who ordered the material might have moved on to another job by the time it leaves the factory. So you've got to figure it these days, especially everyone's jumping jobs so quickly. That's still true. I mean, it's still true. You were saying about sales teams. I still know plenty of sales teams, and the gap between the finance team and the sales team is still there. They're still wondering, mm-hmm, you know, they don't know whether that customer is actually really closed. Did the cash hit? All that sort of stuff. Yeah. It's still a problem that we see. So, okay, well, let's skip forward a little bit then. So after, you know, you came back to London, I believe, after that, and less mucky, let's say the more rarefied air of the London VC scene is where you've been cutting your teeth after that. So just tell us about what's the VC scene like at the moment now, sort of mid to late 2024? Has it been for the last decade or so?
Yeah, I mean, the last decade, it's certainly been incredible. Certainly the UK, I think, is number three now in terms of VC funding after the US and China. You know, we punch above our weight from a venture perspective. And I think a lot of that is down to London, the infrastructure that we have, the sort of the nature of finance and the various regulatory sort of regimes that we've had that have allowed people to sandbox and, you know, work with the regulator and figure stuff out. And that's, you know, and that's grown. And I always say where capital flows, talent follows, and vice versa. So, you know, again, certainly, you know, for the first half of the 2010s, we had a pretty free kind of movement of labor, which, you know, which just makes it easy when you have, you know, when there is paucity of talent on the ground, but you can bring that labor in from elsewhere, that talent in from elsewhere. I think that really makes life easier. So yeah, look, we've had some, you know, incredible sort of stories over the course of the 2010s, right up until kind of the early 2020s, partly fueled obviously by the zero interest rate period that we were living through, right? And I think a lot of people would be aware that that era led to ultimately in sort of 2020, 2021, a lot of hubristic investing, a lot of what, you know, professionals would call tourist VCs, people who kind of entered the market from other areas and started just throwing cash at startups, and anything with a bit of tech would get funded, you know, not quite as bad as the dot-com bubble, but, you know, certainly up there. And we saw valuations sort of inflating to really kind of astonishing amounts, you know, businesses that were not creating any value with hundreds of millions of dollars of valuation. And then really that came crashing back down in 2021 into 2022 and 23, and now in 24 as well. You know, essentially that was a function of a couple of things, but mainly the fact that interest rates go up. When interest rates go up, you know, investors are able to find less risky products to invest in and gain similar returns. And I think there was a realization, a bit of a reckoning within the VC ecosystem that maybe some of the deals that were being done, you know, there hadn't been the discipline that was needed, right? People weren't doing the diligence. People weren't sort of really understanding sure. What was behind the businesses. And now as we're sort of coming to the tail end of 2024, the reality is that we've seen, you know, the deal volume is down, deal velocity is down, so fewer deals and taking longer to do them. But what I am seeing, and I think this is, I mean, certainly for me, this is encouraging, is that the sort of capital that is being invested is going into very R&D heavy businesses that are creating some IP that, you know, actually does have long-term value, or could or should have long-term value, let's say, because no business is guaranteed. And what this means is that VC has kind of reverted to what it, I guess, did in the early days of venture capital back in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s in the US, where, you know, they were investing in hardware, they were investing in, you know, in sort of chip manufacturing, this sort of stuff, right? So what we're now seeing, I think, in 2024 is a realization that, okay, we shouldn't be investing in everything that has a bit of tech in it. Great. We're investing in businesses that are, you know, slightly more R&D heavy, you know, which are capturing value down the track, so they may not commercialize immediately. That's okay. But equally, the focus has shifted from valuation to tangible metrics. I mean, you know, this is the Gross Profit Podcast. At the end of the day, the shift to real financial returns has started happening. And I think, you know, someone said it really clearly to me recently. You know, we've gone from looking at a business in terms of, does it have a $1 billion valuation, to actually, does it have $100 million in ARR, right? So shifting the focus from the valuation to the actual underlying performance of the business. Now, we all know revenue is, you know, revenue can be vanity, but, you know, it's a good shift because it certainly suggests that the business is doing something that people value and are willing to pay for. So you know, where we are today, I think we're in an interesting phase where I think a lot of founders are still grappling with this status quo now, that just because you have a software business doesn't mean you will get funded, which should never have been the case in any case, or certainly won't necessarily get funded by venture capital. But I think that is a positive thing. And I think you'll see very strong businesses built as a result of that.
I guess for good or ill, it's a different thing, right? So venture valuations, or let's say I call them enterprise valuations, like a way to grow a business just to grow the enterprise value of it, is different and not necessarily, well, you can take a view whether it's right or wrong. That's what they do in the stock market all day long, right? So you have people right. Who are just, you know, think they read the news, they think, well, okay, that's going to raise the value of that stock. They're not really worried about the sales orders or the gross volume or the gross margin or anything else. And that's, there's a huge industry that works in that way. It's just that maybe that industry isn't there. The big difference is the cash went away. And would you say, I mean, there's obviously less, you know, there's still a lot of talk about dry powder being out there. There's still a lot of people who've raised a lot of money, maybe didn't deploy it. Is it that they are just even less likely to deploy it than they were before? Or have some of those funds just sort of wound up unable to deploy the capital, and there's effectively fewer VCs on the scene, which means that it's harder to get funded? Or just the same number of VCs, it's just they're more and more conservative?
No, so there's a few things happening. We are definitely seeing, you know, one or two funds shutting up doors, maybe returning capital back to investors. But I don't think that is the sort of norm or the direction of travel. I think we may see fewer funds go on to raise subsequent funds down the track, you know, that may well happen, but I think it's slightly early because a lot of people raise, say, in sort of 2019, 20, 21, those funds still have sort of, you know, 7 to 10 years of life ahead of them. And who knows what will happen in the next 7 to 10 years. There is definitely dry powder out there. The funds that are, you know, all funds have to deploy at the end of the day, unless they wind up the fund. Ultimately, the purpose of a VC fund is to invest capital on behalf of their LPs. So you know, they have a duty to do that to some extent. What I think is happening is that they are investing more capital into fewer businesses, essentially. So really taking bigger bets on companies that they really see as breakthrough, but still with discipline. So I think, as I say, that kind of approach, and again, you know, most VCs will tell you that they were disciplined during that era, but, you know, who knows?
The valuations would indicate otherwise, but yeah.
Well, yeah. So, but it depends on whether those VCs were going into those companies with those sort of valuations. But, you know, if there is data that shows this. In fact, I'm going to have someone on the podcast soon, hopefully, to talk through some of it. But what is being seen is valuations at the median sort of level have come down quite considerably. But the top quartile of businesses, i.e. the really strong performers, are still raising at very strong valuations. You know, there hasn't been as significant a dip. So, no, I think, as I said, the dry powder is out there. It has to get deployed. I think VCs are just being more selective, rightly so, around the businesses that they invest in, and are probably deploying slightly bigger checks into fewer businesses.
Okay. So just before we talk about Emerge One and this amazing growth spurt you've managed to put together in the last 4 years, you took your own sort of detour onto the other side of the table, as they say, taking advantage of that environment, if you like. And maybe just tell us a little bit about that. And what did you learn from, you know, being on the tech founder side of the table?
Yeah, I mean, there's various things I learned. So I think the first thing was probably less about the Zerpia, it was more about sort of ego. I think I raised money because I could, not because I needed to. And I think that was driven partly by, well, I'm in this space, I should be able to go out and raise some money. And I had great relationships with investors. And I must hasten to add, none of these were VC. Well, some of them are now VC investors, and some of them are invested in their personal capacity whilst they are VCs as their day job. But the amazing thing, I guess, sort of fast forwarding to the end, is all of those investors, I think, were incredibly supportive, even when I decided to ultimately wind up the business. And I think, you know, raising money is not for everyone. I realized over time it definitely isn't for me. You know, I'm 46 odd years old. I don't want to be beholden to other people. I like building under my own steam. I'm also not the guy that's going to build a $1 billion business, I don't think, right? Or certainly wasn't passionate enough or driven enough, or saw that problem that I was trying to solve was big enough or hard enough that it really had me sort of gripped with the sort of fever to want to solve it and crack it in a way that other people hadn't. Not that I wasn't trying to solve a problem, but I just realized as we were building that actually the dynamics were off. It was the right product for the wrong market. And when we pivoted to a completely sort of different product, I was essentially trying to solve for my laziness. I was trying to make myself redundant. How do I build a virtual CFO? But by the time I sort of hit on something that I thought could work, and we were starting to see some early, very early sort of green shoots of traction, we were pretty much at the end of our runway. And I made the decision that, no, this is not for me. If, you know, the market was already sort of tough in any case, but I thought it was more sensible to wind the business down, kind of close it out cleanly and move on.
It's funny you say, I mean, you say your own laziness, but effectively that's what we're all kind of doing, right? We're all trying to, you know, grow capital. The idea of having, you know, something work without us is very alluring. It's alluring, rather. It's a business that doesn't need you in order to grow. That's the dream. And there's kind of a contradiction there, because, you know, often there's a lot of founder porn out there about how hard you work and the grit and the, you know, the fake it till you make it and the whatever, all the things you need to do. And but at the same time, at the end of the day, what do you think? Well, what are they trying to do? Well, they're trying to, you know, create value so that a business runs without them, and they can, you know, I don't know how many would say they want to go and sit on the beach, but if you really asked them, I'd say a fair amount would.
I definitely would. I mean, like, look, let me put it this way. I am the most hardworking, lazy person you'll meet, right? But the way I've sort of run my life is figured out ways to hack my laziness, right? So laziness is a superpower, right? How do I make my job easier? And that's what I've kind of done throughout my life. But yeah, at the moment, you know, I run a business, I run a podcast, I write a newsletter, I'm writing a book, I speak at events, I do a whole bunch of other stuff and run every day and, you know, spend time with my family and all the rest of it. So, you know, it's always a bit tongue in cheek. I'm lazy in the sense that I don't want to have to work, but I also know that the only way I'm going to figure out how to get there is by working bloody hard. So yeah, I mean, you know, ultimately the goal would be to sit on a beach, but you've got to put in the graft to get there.
Many years ago, my wife and I went to a Tony Robbins event in London, and she sat beside a guy from Poland, and the guy was, you know, she got talking to him, and she said, he explained that, you know, he owned a hotel and several apartment blocks and so on. He was young, he was in his early 20s. And she asked him, you know, how did you do this? Like, what? You're very young and you have all this. And he looked her dead in the eye and he said, well, the truth is, I just really hate working. And this seemed like easier than working, was it? Like, and he built it up with credit cards and whatever. And he hated work so much that he done all this investment and created all this stuff just so that he wouldn't have to work. Now, obviously he worked his tail off in the process, but there's nothing, I'm not totally against being laziness as a motivator.
But that comes down to kind of, I think Naval Ravikant talks about this as well, but you can, you know, you leverage technology, people or content, right? Like those are the three things that you can leverage which is probably the most important one, right? So if you're going to leverage technology, you build a product and then it makes money while you sleep. If you leverage content, you build a podcast or a newsletter or whatever. And again, hopefully at some point that monetizes and you can.
Yeah, well, we're foreshadowing your business hero there, which I like, but I want to hear about Emerge One. So you've managed to build a practice very quickly. So having, you know, gone through that experience, helping people raise fund and then done it yourself, you know, at some stage, were you like me? Were you like, oh no, now I need to make a living. What the hell am I going to do? And what was the birthplace for this business as it stands today?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. The first thing is I'm unemployable. I don't like working for other people at all. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, my comment around not wanting, you know, to be beholden to others, even in terms of capital. But yeah, I don't think I could go into a full-time job working for other people. I really enjoy doing what I enjoy doing, not being told what to do, I guess is probably the best way of putting it. So no, there was a couple of things. So I was working as a portfolio, as we'd have called it, FD, CFO, sort of from 2017, 18, 19. And it's great. It's really awesome. You get to work with, you know, multiple clients doing lots of stuff, but you hit on an obvious issue, which is a scaling problem, right? There is a limit to the amount of time you can put into anything, which is where you'd either build potentially technology or leverage people or whatever, right? And what had happened was, I think by nature of the kind of content that I was putting out on LinkedIn and elsewhere, I was getting CFOs and FDs that were pinging me and saying, we really like what you're doing, you know, can you help us? And I'm like, okay, fine. So I started putting one or two of them into roles. And then in 2020, as a pandemic hit, I kind of doubled down on that proposition because I said, well, okay, again, I'm lazy. I don't like working. I don't want to be the CFO in the business. I can be, and I am still with one or two clients. But if I really want to do what I love doing, and what it turns out that I love doing is speaking to, I mean, linguists at the end of the day, right? Speaking to people, running this podcast, writing content. Like, this is stuff that I was really good at. Like, I kind of fell into finance, right? It wasn't necessarily a decision other than, well, I better do something because I don't know what I'm going to do otherwise, right? But it's really crazy. I could kind of take a detour into education, but essentially, you know, it took me 25 years to figure out what I was good at, right? And what I'm good at is building relationships, speaking to people, finding solutions for them, leading people, not managing them. I'm an awful manager, absolutely, which is why having 25 CFOs who are, like, you know, very senior can manage themselves is a really valuable sort of way to build a business. But yeah, so it was kind of this realization, A, that I wanted to build something that went beyond me, B, the fact that I was lazy and didn't really want to work, C, the need to focus on the things that I did enjoy doing. And as a result of all of that, kind of that genesis or that sort of confluence of those sort of things suggested to me that the most obvious way to do that was to build and scale Emerge One into what it is today, which is, you know, consultancy providing fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups. And I think we carved and have carved, you know, a pretty good niche for ourselves in that space. I don't think there's anyone that's tackling it quite in the way that we do. And the other thing I think it's really important to say is that I'm in no way romanticizing what we do, and I'm in no way. And you know, this is going to sound awful, but I think there's a lot of businesses out there that try and sex up what finance is, and like, yeah, we've got tech that can do this, and we'll layer in a guy that can do X. And I'm like, yeah, this is all rubbish, because every single business is different. So the, you know, the USP for us is one of our CFOs comes into your business and helps you scale it and builds the finance team and the tech stack that you need for finance, and helps you fundraise and helps you do all the things that we do without any of the noise and any of the sort of shiny, well, you know, we'll do it with a dashboard that we built on the side, which is, you know, essentially what I attempted to do in the other business. But that was the realization. Actually, this is a, you know, this is a function that is driven by people.
So that you raised something there, which is interesting to me, because I've seen, you know, people who really manage to shine a light on what a great CFO can do in your business. I think it's an incredibly powerful position, probably maybe the most powerful position in an organization, but it's rarely framed as such. It's often framed as, you know, cash flow projections or balance sheet. I don't know, accountants love balance sheet stuff that no one really knows about, but like it has to be done. If you were to say, if you wanted to hire your first CFO, you're in a, you know, a growing business, what's the proper way to brief a CFO versus an accounting function? Like, what's the best, you know, what's the best brief you can give a CFO to get the most from them?
Yeah, for sure. So I think there's a couple of things. First of all, so what does a CFO do? Like, the fundamental role of the CFO is to manage capital. If you don't have capital in your business, you don't need a CFO, right? And by capital, I mean, you know, you've raised seven figures, or you're, you know, you're generating a couple of million revenue, you've got cash flow. There is money to be managed in more than one way, right? I think if you're an early stage business that is still building out products, has raised a couple of, you don't need a CFO, mate. You need a, you know, you need someone who can help you with a spreadsheet, and that's probably going to be an investor and advisor, right? So the trigger point for bringing in a CFO typically is you've raised your first sort of significant institutional round of capital, and your investors essentially want someone in the room that is a safe pair of hands that can help you manage that capital, but also bring some structure to the business, right? So, you know, what does a CFO do? A CFO manages, you know, the capital. So it's capital management along, you know, around runway and burn. It's capital allocation. Where do we invest that cash, right? Do we hire this person here? What's the treasury management side of it? You know, how do we actually use that capital? It's capital structuring. You know, do we look at debt? Do we look at equity? What is better? What does a business have a better profile for? Can we raise equity? Can we raise at the valuation that makes sense? Can we raise debt? You know, is it going to be too expensive for us, or can we afford to repay it? All of those sort of things. And then it's obviously capital raising, right? Which is a function of the debt and equity sort of structuring, is like, okay, let's go out and raise either that debt or that equity. Okay, what do we need to do that? We need financial models. We need a data room. We need diligence. We need, you know, all sorts of sort of collateral that is then used in that fundraising process. We need someone to go and speak to these people in the language of finance, right? Now, obviously, you know, the founder, the CEO is the person that is likely in it. And I'm talking about earlier stage businesses here, right? They are the people that have to sell the vision of the business, for sure. Your CFO is not going to go there and close an investor by nature of talking through the numbers. However, you know, certainly as you get on in stage, you want someone with that confidence in the numbers that is able to go and have that conversation with the analyst or with the VC or with the with the bank, okay, or whoever it is, to have those conversations.
Yeah, it reminds me. I mean, I remember several years ago, I ran, you know, I had to do something vaguely legalistic. I think it might have been, I can't remember what it was, but I ran it by a lawyer, and I said, listen, this is the phrasing I'm thinking of using. And he looked at it and he said, well, you can say that. It means absolutely nothing in legal terms, but you can definitely say it, but if it makes you feel better. And I feel like that's maybe people don't realize the mistakes are, you know, if you're dealing with other finance professionals, you actually need someone on your team who knows how to speak that language, or you're going to make a catastrophic mistake maybe, and you may not even know you're making. Just by your level of professionalism, people will rate that, right? They'll level how good the accounts look and everything.
It's an indicator, right? Like, it shows something about it. I mean, the other thing we see, and we see this a lot, is founders, again, because many of them don't have business experience, and certainly very few of them have finance experience, when they go out and they hire an FD or a CFO, that person is often not fit for purpose. They don't, you know, just because they have been an accountant does not mean that they have the experience, the knowledge, and the ability to perform that kind of CFO role. So, you know, we have had founders come to us, ask us to rebuild a model. We'll look at the model that has been built by their outgoing FD or, you know, someone who's built it. And, you know, hard-coded numbers, there's nothing that is tracking through. You can't sort of adjust it. It's not dynamic. And you sort of are, well, who built this? Well, our FD did. Well, then they weren't an FD because, like, you know, I would not bring this person anywhere near my team if they were purporting to be an FD. So I think, and a lot of what I do, certainly a lot of the content that I put out there is about educating people in general, founders specifically, you know, what is a CFO versus what is finance operations, right? And how do you make that distinction between the two? And it is a really important distinction. And I guess the simplest way that I put it, or I can put it, is finance operations looks inwards and backwards, i.e. it's looking inside the business and it's looking backwards, reporting on what's happened. The CFO function, strategic finance, is about looking forwards and outward. So it's looking out into the market where the opportunities are and into the future rather than necessarily just looking at past performance.
Very good. Well, that maybe brings us to a good point to ask about how can people find out more about that, some of that content. Where can they consume some of that content that you're putting out online?
For sure. I mean, look, the easiest place to find me is on LinkedIn. So my handle is ADSINUK, ADSINUK, or just search for Arish Shah, two A's, R-I-S-H, Shah, S-H-A-H, and follow me there. All the sort of links to the podcast, the newsletter, et cetera, in my bio. And obviously, if you do want to follow the podcast, just search for Nothing Ventured on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or wherever it is you get your podcasts.
So to wrap things up then, I have my rinky-dink little last question I ask everyone, which is, you know, who is your business hero and why?
Yeah, so I don't really have a business hero per se. I think, I mean, I read a lot and I consume a lot of content from, I think, leaders in their field, but I've never sort of sat there and go, I really want to be like this guy. I think the closest I've come to someone who I think really speaks in a language that I appreciate, understand, and would aspire to, at least to some extent, is Naval Ravikant, who is the founder of AngelList and amongst other things. And, you know, there are two things that I think really stand out for me. So one is, you know, I spoke about earlier, leveraging money, people, content, and capital. And I think when you start framing things in that way, you know, you start making decisions that are appropriate. But for me, the most important thing, and it goes back right back to the beginning, the top of the conversation, is he talks about playing long-term games with long-term people. And I think that means building deep, meaningful relationships with people that actually are worth building long-term relationships with. And it's, you know, I'd never put it into words before myself, but when I read that sort of aphorism, it completely resonated with how I've sort of run my life till now.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy, like we were talking about beforehand, this world to think in the very short term, and it's a long career. And it seems like it's such an easy hack in a way, if you're just thinking slightly longer term than everyone else, like a 5 or 10 year, maybe have a child. That would help. Yeah. That helped me change my perspective on time spans.
Well, when you have a child, it's incredible. You obviously start thinking long term, but then urgency comes in as well, because you realize, wow, I've got a child now, and, you know, I need to ensure that their life is better than mine, right? Which is obviously what I think all parents aspire to.
1,000%. People say to me, oh, you know, I would love to have started a business, but I, you know, whatever, I got married. And I was like, well, that's exactly what to me. I had a pregnant wife and no really good way of making my way in the world. And that was and a gun to was put to my head. And that's the end of it. That's the end of it. You're amazed what you can do when you put yourself under pressure like that.
Completely so agree.
I've really, really enjoyed this discussion. I feel like we're kind of kindred in some ways. I love the way you are own up to use the L word. Sometimes in a meeting in our business, I'll say, blah, 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 or were you just lazy? And everyone looks at me and says, you can't just ask people if they're lazy. And I'm like, well, I'm lazy all the time. I presume other people are lazy. If we didn't do this because we were lazy, I would rather just know, and then we can work around that, because that's, you know, I am. Why wouldn't anyone else be? But so let's popularize honesty with ourselves and our team with that.
Absolutely. I think you've got to own who you are at the end of the day. And I know exactly who I am.
Arish, thank you very much. And thank you. If you're still listening to the podcast, congratulations. You have earned something very special. And that is the right and the privilege of going to procurementexpress.com/partners. I've just finished a new webinar. It's aimed for ADOs who are we work with on time. And I've got a case study there with a guy called Den de la Cretas. Ben is one of our fractionals that we work at all the time. And Procurement Express is part of the toolkit that he uses to crack down on costs and put controls around spending when he works with a new client, specifically in the biotech industry. So if you go to procurementexpress.com/partners, you can sign up for that webinar and maybe learn a bit about how Ben does it, how he adds value to his customers. And I've also added in a section there about my humble opinion on how fractional CFOs can really sell the value of what they do. So Arish, thank you very much for coming along. It's been a lot of fun.
Really appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.